I sincerely offer my gratitude to all of you for giving this precious time to attending this evening's program. There are so many alternatives of how to spend our time in life. And this is very much which determines the destiny of each soul. How we choose to utilize every precious moment we have. According to the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedic scriptures, destiny is unavoidable, but we create it ourselves, because it is the law of nature. For every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. Or as they say, what goes up must come down. It is a law. It is not a question of our opinion. It is not dependent on our scholarship and how many volumes of literatures we can write giving our opinion. But it is a law of nature. For every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. And subtler than this law applying to physics is on the platform of subtle material nature. The power of our thoughts, the power of our feelings, affects the world. What to speak of the power of our speech and actions? Human life is distinguished from the lower species because a human being has the power to determine the direction of life he or she wishes to travel. The lower species have no such power. They simply act according to the dictations of the nature of the particular body they live. But a human can do anything. We could be moral, immoral, honest, dishonest, humble, egoistic. We have that power. And with the power comes responsibility. Throughout history, we see that people who have great power could either bring about great good or terrible destruction. With power comes responsibility. The difference between a grown parent and a small child is power. Physical power, intellectual power, discriminatory power. Therefore, if you have a child, you have a great responsibility to protect, to care for, and to guide. So with the responsibility of our free will in this human life, which is a great power, is much responsibility. And whatever we choose, there will be a reaction. And the accumulation of the actions and words that we decide to perform is what determines our destiny. What is coming upon us today is very much the effects of the choices we have made in the past. And how we respond, how we react to what is coming upon us will determine our future. Not only in this life, but in future lives as well. And it is all set in motion at every moment according to the choices we make. Life is so short. Sometimes it is said that youth is wasted on the young. Because when you start getting older, you realize how valuable every moment is. And as you get even older, you start realizing how precious every moment is. And as you get older, you realize how time is flying past us, and we can't hold on to it. As a child, seconds take a long time to pass. Do you remember in school, just waiting for the bell to ring? Not the bell to bring you into the class, but the bell to let you out of the class. Seemed to last for ages. But if you speak to an 80-year-old man or woman, it seems like life has passed in moments. And factually, in the light of eternity, it has. Every moment is so precious. We're forming our destiny. We're either covering or uncovering the beauty of our own souls. Therefore, the Vedanta Sutra begins with the aphorism, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, that now that you have attained this precious human life, it is time to inquire into our true and eternal welfare. Who am I? Where am I going? Where am I coming from? Why is there suffering? What is real happiness? Who is God? And what is my relationship with that God? And what is my true relationship with all living beings? When we really, sincerely make an effort to understand these questions and act according to what will answer those questions, then the beauty of human life begins to blossom. It is said that you cannot judge a book by looking at its cover. One who has faith in the supreme beauty of God's love, can see beyond the external appearances of what comes upon us in life. One who sees the invisible is a person who has a great future of success. That is wisdom. This afternoon, I was with about 50 devotees from London having a meeting. But first, I'll tell you why I was late for that meeting. I spent the afternoon with Ambarish Das, whose secular name is Alfred Brush Ford. He's the great-grandson of Henry Ford, who really promoted the proliferation of automobiles through creating an assembly line. Wherever he goes, our friend, he can go to any television station, any newspaper, magazine, and just say, I'm Henry Ford's great-grandson, in any country in the world, and they'll be surrounding him with microphones and cameras. Just a few years ago, I was in Moscow, and it was given notice to the press that the great-grandson of Henry Ford is coming. Every major television station, every radio station, every newspaper and every magazine was waiting at immigration to greet him. And they were interviewing him and asking for press conferences and inviting him to their shows. And he told me, what did I do? All I did is I was born. I haven't done anything. He doesn't even work for the Ford Motor Company. But because of that connection to a famous personality. So today we spent a few hours together. And then these devotees from the United Kingdom came, and I was supposed to speak to them. And they were waiting. But I wanted to just show proper hospitality to my dear friend, so I went to the street to see him to his car. But because of intense Bombay traffic, which I'm sure all of you have experience of, his car couldn't get to the temple because it parked somewhere else. And his secretary and the driver were talking on cell phones. Where are you? I'm stuck in traffic. Well, where did you park? Around the block. It took almost 15 minutes for him to just round the corner to get to the temple. So we were waiting and waiting. And finally, do you want to hear this story? The car came, pulled to the side of the road. And there was car after car after car passing. He couldn't pull out of his parking place for almost another 10 minutes. And meanwhile, the London devotees are waiting in the garden, and I'm trying to see him off. And finally, there was a small gap in the traffic, and his car was just about to rush out. And Alfred Ford rolled down his window and looked at me and said, "It is all Henry Ford's fault." Very humble person, actually. So I came in the garden, and I was thinking about these wonderful devotees in London. In the early 1970s, two of our very dear godbrother, godsister, actually, they came to London in the late 60s. Yamuna Devi Prabhu and Shyam Sundar Prabhu. What they did was simply amazing. They started a temple in San Francisco in 1967. And our Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, he sent three household couples, 6.5 devotees, one baby who was just months old, and 6 adults, 3 married couples. He sent them to London. They didn't have money. They didn't have contacts. And they were supposed to start a temple there. And they did. Shyamasundara Prabhu, he had this idea that if we reach influential people, then common people will be influenced. And being a hippie from his past, his conception of a really influential person was epitomized by the Beatles. So we will give Krishna to the Beatles. And somehow or other, it's a long story, but he did. Within a month or two, they were all living in John Lennon's house. Soon after, even before that, the Beatles produced a record for them, a single record where Yamuna was singing the Hare Krishna mantra, produced by George Harrison. It was put on the top 40, and it was the number one song in Europe. Hundreds and thousands of people buying Hare Krishna just to hear our sweet, loving Yamuna singing. And then Shyamasundara moved in a house with George Harrison. And after some time, they started a small temple just a couple blocks from the British Museum on Berry Place in downtown London. Very nice building. But it was soon overcrowded. So many people. And Prabhupada, our Gurudev, saw what inconvenience such crowded facilities. He was feeling always sarva suketu bhavantu, let everyone be happy. So he asked, try to find a bigger place. But how to find a bigger place when they couldn't even pay for the small place that they were living in? So Shyamasundara Prabhu discussed this with George Harrison, and he decided to buy a beautiful Victorian mansion in the countryside. And it was named Bhaktivedanta Manor. And Prabhupada made that estate the headquarters of the Hare Krishna movement for all of Europe, and spent so much time. But soon that was overcrowded. So they had to get another place. But anyways, these devotees I were meeting today were from Bhaktivedanta Manor. Many of them were of Indian origin. There are thousands and thousands of people who come to the temple and who are actively participating. For Janmashtami, for almost a couple months before the event, there's up to 800 volunteers working after work every night of the week, sometimes till midnight, just to prepare for the festival. Out of devotion. Now there was some complaints, and the government years ago decided to close Bhaktivedanta Manor from any public worship because it was creating traffic congestion in the villages because there were thousands and thousands of people coming for festivals. And it was a law coming from the central government that worship was banned. So many people, their hearts were very much broken. and they appealed the decision, and they lost. They appealed the appeal, and they lost. They started doing demonstrations. Some were getting arrested. They united with other minority religious groups, had demonstrations with thousands and thousands of people in front of the parliament building. And the police broke it up and arrested others. And this went on for about 10 years. And there wasn't even a ray of hope, of success. They were just losing every battle. But they had faith. They had faith that they were not doing anything wrong. They were doing the right thing. And ultimately, it's a long story that volumes of books could be written describing in detail. But in the end, they not only won the war and were given complete freedom for worship, but they also got property all the way to a road connecting to the highway, which made the property of Bhaktivedanta Manor about 10 times bigger than it was when they started the fight. A driveway right to a road connecting to highway, which gives places of parking for thousands and thousands of cars. And the congregation has increased immensely. And none of this would have happened if they didn't close us down. So when obstacles come in our lives, we should know that those obstacles are not bad, whatever they may be. They're bad if you perceive them as bad and act accordingly. But if we see the impediments that come in our life as opportunities to grow, opportunity to go deeper into our surrender to God, opportunities to more helplessly cry out for the Lord's help and chant his holy names, then it is assured. Because success in life is not about some external accomplishment. Success in life is about expressing the integrity of our will before God, who is the witness within. Atapumbir vijastrestas varanashrama vibhagasha shvanushtatasya dharmasya samsadir haritoshanam. Whatever our occupation, whatever our field of life may be, our success is if we please Krishna, the Lord who is all attractive, all loving, and all merciful. Just recently, within our temple, we had a wonderful devotee who passed away from this world. Many of you knew him, Stoka Krishna Prabhu. His passing was beautiful. Now, this is a very esoteric concept. How could death be beautiful? For many, death means the end of life. How could that ever be? be beautiful. If it were the end of life, it's horrible. But life, we learn from all the great self-realized souls and all the great holy books, life is eternal. Bhagavad Gita tells, Najayate mriyate vakadachin. For the soul, the source of life, the animating power within us, the consciousness, there is no birth, there is no death. Nahanyate hanyamane sarire. It is not slain when the body is slain. Dehinosmin yata dehe, komaram yovaram jara. Tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatra namu yate. As the soul is traveling through the various stages in this life, from childhood to youth to old age, in the same way the soul transmigrates at the time of death. And what is the overall consciousness? What is it that we accumulate the greatest attachment for in our life? That determines the journey of the soul after it departs from this body. So a person who understands this, that death is simply a transitional state. It is not the end. One who dies, one who gives up the body in a very elevated state of consciousness, it is beautiful. It is inevitable to everyone. But we have our choice, how we will live and how we will die. Stoka Krishna had cancer, incurable, fast deterioration. But he was always smiling. He was always grateful. He was happy. I spoke to him on the phone many times from the West, and he was always just thanking God for all the wonderful opportunities that the Lord gave him to serve in his life. He was not focusing on how little time he had to live and cursing in frustration. Rather, he was grateful from the core of his heart for every moment the Lord gave him the opportunity to serve, to be with the devotees, to hear the glories of the Lord, and to chant Krishna's names. It wasn't just a mental disposition. It was a realization. It was an experience. And even in that state, he was giving so much to others. Devotees simply loved to come to see him because of what they were receiving from him. And even though his body was becoming utterly emaciated, breaking to pieces, his organs just disintegrating, he maintained that same consciousness. I can tell you, in my observation, he was happier in that state than practically the entire population of Mumbai, sitting in their cars in the traffic jams, listening to music, or arguing with each other, I don't know. Going to the nightlife, trying to somehow or other find someone to enjoy with, something to enjoy, somehow or other, enjoy. But he was enjoying greater than them. He was paralyzed from his waist down, but he was happy. He was grateful. And he was immersed in devotion to Krishna, to the Lord. and he left the world in that state. It was beautiful. What is the lesson? We have our choice. How are we going to perceive the reality that has come upon us? Sometimes we are in a situation which is beyond our control. We're frustrated when we want to control and things go out of our control. Yes? But when we accept the situation and look for the opportunity to come closer to God in that situation and to grow, then there's fulfillment. There's happiness. And not only that, there's the experience of the presence of Krishna within us. And that is beautiful. So yes, this is an extreme example. But whatever comes upon us, we can make our choice. Sometimes we're honored, and sometimes we're criticized, personally or even publicly. For one who is honored, dishonor is worse than death. But for one who sees a divine reason behind it, dishonor is more blissful than honor. Because life is not about being honored and dishonored. Life is about how we respond to each of those situations. And the observation of the Lord within the heart. There may be pleasure or pain. There may be success or failure. There may be victory or defeat. It's usually beyond our control. We try our best and still. God helps them who help themselves. We must try our best. Krishna tells in Gita that we must give up egoism and laziness. There is no place for laziness on a spiritual path. There must be determination. There must be enthusiasm based on faith in whatever we do. That brings about progress. Some people think that people take to spiritual path to run away from the problems of this world, to live a lazy life. And unfortunately, it's often true. But that is not a spiritual path. Those who actually face the real problems of life, birth, old age, disease, death, forgetfulness of our relationship with God, and are enthusiastic, determined to perform our duties in this world for that purpose, to come closer to our essence and our source. That is spiritual. That is what Gita teaches. So every moment we have an opportunity. And any moment that is lost cannot be bought back for all the wealth in the creation. Any moment spent wisely in the service of the Lord is an eternal investment. And those who know modern business management, you are aware that how you manage your time is very critical. And it even more critical in our spiritual lives. How we manage our time. The decisions we make. Yes, a situation comes upon us. It may be just what we want. Or it may be exactly what we despise the most. It might be just what we have feared will come upon us. We may be praised. We may be blamed. But will we respond with humility or false ego? Will we respond with anger and vengeance or compassion and forgiveness? Will we respond by giving up or by learning a good lesson and carrying on stronger than ever with greater determination? Will we respond by cursing God or thanking God? That is our choice. So I thank you very much. Here in Mumbai, there are so many alternatives. In small villages, there aren't so many alternatives. If somebody is speaking from Bhagavad Gita in a village, everyone will come. Because there's nothing else to do except sleep. But Mumbai, how many things to do? Every hoarding or billboard is inviting us. So many things to do. Right there, Johnny Walker. That is a type of alcoholic beverage, I believe. And earth, wind, fire. Our dear friend Richard used to travel with them. Yes? Is it not a small world? Every hoarding, every shop, practically every person you meet is advertising their consciousness. In fact, Srila Prabhupada, he said that monks wear these types of robes just because people dress in such a way to advertise their consciousness. If a man or woman dresses in a very seductive way, they're expressing, you know, their desire to attract your sensual feelings. If some people dress in a way to show people how wealthy they are or how beautiful they are. Well, traditionally in religions all over the world, monks cut their hair and wear these sloppy little clothes. Why? So that when people see you, whether they like it or not, they think, it's a man of God. Some people say, it's a man of God. And other people say, it's a man of God. But either way, they think of God. Arivo. We'll say there's a, some people will say, it's a Krishna. And other people will say, it's Krishna. But they're thinking of Krishna. So whatever we do in life, we're advertising in some way. By the way we talk, by the way we dress, by the car we drive, everything is some sort of an expression that affects other people's consciousness. When George Harrison asked Prabhupada, should I shave my head and put on these robes? And Prabhupada said, no, you could best serve God by being a beetle. And dress like a beetle and hair like a beetle, whatever that is. And with your influence, bring people closer to God. And he tried to do that. And he influenced tens and thousands of people's lives in a very powerful way. that is one example out of so many millions of examples. But we have our freedom at every moment. How we're going to respond to our situation, how we're going to grow, how we're going to come closer to God, and how we're going to influence others in a very positive way. Sarva Suketu Bhavantu. Prabhupada said, and we quoted this in the marriage yesterday, this is the purpose of marriage, this is the purpose of life. Let everyone be happy. To live in such a way to make others happy. Happiness of the body, happiness of the mind, but especially the happiness of our eternal self, our soul, which rejoices in that connection to the all-attractive supreme object of everyone's love, the Supreme Lord, Govinda. In this age of Kali, it is proclaimed that this love for God, this blissful state of Satchit Ananda, is dormant within the heart of every living being. It is not an artificial imposition of the mind. It is not just adjusting the mind in such a way to see a certain way. The need to love, the joy of love, is our essence. Love of God, knowledge of God, who is the all-beautiful, all-loving, all-compassionate person, is within us all. It simply must be uncovered like a treasure under the ground. Such great wealth must simply be uncovered from within. This chanting of God's name has the most amazingly effective power to awaken that love of God within us. When we were speaking at a youth festival just a few weeks ago, one student asked a question that, I am a scientist and I can only accept something as being substantial if it is scientifically proved. Can your religion be scientifically proved? Otherwise, I must reject it. So I asked the scientist, what is your definition of science? He said, first there is a hypothesis, then there is experimentation, and then there is evidence. That is science. If anything conforms to those principles, it is science. But if it's just based on faith, it is not science. It's religion. Hare Krishna. Now, our Guru Maharaj often said that we are not professing religion. We are professing science. And in other times, Prabhupada said, the essence of all religion is to love God. So how can Krishna consciousness or any great religious system be understood scientifically? There is a hypothesis. The hypothesis is far more extensive than biological, physiological, or chemical sciences, or even mathematics. How many books? There are Bhagavad Gita, 18 Puranas, 108 Upanishads, 100,000 verses of Mahabharata, Ramayana, Valmiki, Muni. There's the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Holy Quran, and so many supplementary literatures of the great religions of the world. And they are all giving a hypothesis that you are not this body, you are the eternal soul. And that there is a God. Some describe God as a scornful father who will punish you of your sins. If you're naughty, sometimes your father appears like that. I remember when I was a well-behaved boy, which was rare occasions, I really looked forward to my father coming home because my mother would give him good reports. But when I was a naughty boy, a really naughty boy, I was not looking forward to my scornful father coming home. So God is Aham Bija Pratapita. Krishna says, I am this eternal seed-giving father of all living beings. So for those who are very naughty, engaging in many sinful activities, then he's described like your mother. You do this, you will be punished like this when your father gets home. You wait. Yes? How many of you have heard that before? In India also? But if you're well behaved, when your father comes home, he will be so kind. He will play with you. He will do so many wonderful, what he likes to do the best, he will share with you. So the Vedic literatures are telling that side, emphasizing that side. If you live in a spirit of devotion, then here is the beautiful pastimes of the Lord in this spiritual world, the most loving, playful Lord, who will include you in most intimate, loving reciprocations forever. This is described in Srimad Bhagavatam. This is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. And that love for God is dormant within our heart. And by chanting God's names, that love is awakened. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. Through other forms of yoga, we may get supernatural powers, but they're material. They will not satisfy the heart. We may get good health, which is very nice and could be used for very good purposes. But how long will it last? We can gain peace, freedom from anxiety, or even liberation. But only by purifying our heart through loving service to the Lord in a personal way in everything we do, and through developing that consciousness through God's name, can the essence of our real desire or love of God awaken. Therefore, Krishna tells in Gita, after describing the various yogic systems, Yogi namapi sarvesham madgatenantaratmana sharavan bhajate ammam same yuktatamamataha. Of all yogis, one who abides in me with great faith and devotion is most successful and is most perfectly intimately united in yoga with me. Bahunam janmanamante gyanavam mampapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabha. After many births and deaths of practicing various spiritual principles, one who really comes to conclusion surrenders the heart with love. Or as the Bible said, the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. So we are chanting these holy names, not simply for peace, not simply for pious entertainment, but with a deep aspiration to cleanse our hearts and awaken that spirit of eternal loving service from within. And Lord Chaitanya has said, Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. The Sankirtan, God's names descending on earth, is the prime benediction, greatest benediction to all humanity. I thank you very, very much. I would like to introduce some of my very dear friends to you. My God brothers and God sisters who are, I always keep in my heart the feet of these devotees as my worshipable deities. We have Yamuna Devi, Prabhu, Dinatarani Devi, Prabhu, Vishaka Devi, Prabhu, Lakshmi Moni Devi, Prabhu, Niranjan Swami Maharaj, Chandramali Swami Maharaj, Sham Sundar Prabhu, who have kindly come here to bless us, tolerating my talks once again. And we have Niranjan Swami Maharaj's very dear elder sister, who has yesterday officially accepted me as her younger brother, Sandy. Let us welcome her. And there is my lifelong friend, Gary. Most of you were here last year when we spoke about the supernatural occurrences that took place in our relationship in life. We were best friends as children in the early 1960s. And we're still best friends, almost 50 years later. He lives a very different life than mine, and I live a very different life than his. And when you see him, it will be quite evident. He's a physical trainer, teaching people to have very strong bodies. One day, we were at the Baha'i Temple in Illinois, near Chicago. And he said, Swami, how is it that we're such good friends? I'm telling everyone that they'll be happy if they have a strong body, and you're telling everyone that they're not their body. I consider that a very reasonable question. So I tried to think of a reasonable answer. I said, we are a team. You teach them the body is the temple of God. The soul is the part of God. And God is within the heart of every living being. The body is a temple of God. So you teach people how to keep their temple very strong and good. And I'll try to explain what they're supposed to do inside the temple. So we have formed a team in this way. But he loves all of you so much, and I know how much all of you love him. And seeing this relationship gives me such deep satisfaction. Let us welcome Gary back to Bombay. And we also have his younger brother, Richard, who was a very, very dear friend of myself, you know, throughout my teenage years of life. Wonderful person, very open-minded, has spiritual thirst, and is just such good-hearted soul. Let us welcome Richard to Bombay. And amazing. It shocked Gary, it shocked me, it shocked Richard when Gary's aunt, Shelley, expressed her desire to come to India. Shelley is such a motherly person. I first met her when I was the age 17. Gary and I left the small village of Highland Park in northern Illinois and went to California. Now, by Indian standards, it's like going from the earth to the heavenly planets. Because Highland Park, Illinois was the place where there was never anything to do. Yes? When we were young and passionate for enjoyment as teenagers, we'd go out on Saturday night and say, "What should we do?" And we just spend the whole night trying to find something to do. And at the end of the night, we came to the conclusion, there's nothing to do. So we just went home and went to sleep. Yes? We'd meet people, and when we'd meet people, we'd just discuss what we should do. And we'd drive around to different places looking for something to do. But in Highland Park, Illinois, there's just nothing to do. Because people were somewhat pious there. And if you're pious in a place like that, there's really not much to do. But California, we were hearing songs about it. We were reading books about it. We were seeing movies about it. Hollywood. Hollywood is an imitation of Bollywood. By Indian ego. They just changed the B into an H. And there was the Pacific Ocean and people surfing on surfboards. And there was Haight-Ashbury and Laguna Beach and Sunset Strip. So many things we heard about since childhood. So we went to California. It was like a pilgrimage. And we end up like, we had no money. We were sleeping on beaches. And then when we found out we were going to get arrested for that, we'd find houses for sales and climb through the window and sleep on the floor. And then we met Shelley Auntie. Her and her husband, Donald, very prominent personalities. They own entire apartment complexes in Beverly Hills. And they gave us an entire flat, an entire apartment, fully equipped in Beverly Hills. That was a culture shock for us. We kind of made it a mess just to feel at home. And Shelley would come in and clean it. Amazing person. But she has been like a mother since that time, a wonderful, gracious person. She owns a basketball team of the NBA, which in America, to say that somebody owns a basketball team, it cannot be understood by Indian standards. It's a very elevated platform. But when Gary was coming to India, she decided to come also to see all of you and to witness the loving exchange between all of you and Shelley is such a satisfaction to my heart. And to see her happiness is my great, great, great happiness. Thank you very much. Let us very sincerely welcome Shelley to Bombay. And there is Davin and Lynn, who I met in Malibu Beach, California, the last summer and summer before also. They are corporate lawyers or advocates in California, Los Angeles area. And I just met them and invited them to come to India. And they came. I still haven't adjusted to the amazement. They just came. And I have just learned what wonderful, open-hearted, kind, and special people they are. They have developed so much affection for all of you. And all of you who have met them have told me how dear and how much dear affection and respect you have gained for them. Let us welcome them into our family in Bombay. In fact, last night, Davin and Lynn told me that next year they're coming back to India in time for Pushyabhishek, the flower festival. Would any of you like to speak some words? Please come. Is there another microphone? Microphone is coming.
I think this is a blessing to have a microphone in my hand. This has been a wonderful journey for Lynn and Davin. I'll hold it a little closer. We arrived on the day of the last flower festival, and within nine hours, we joined you in a ceremony that for an American like me is something I had never experienced before. Maybe it's hard for you to imagine what it's like to walk into a temple when you've never been in one and see thousands of you chanting, singing, dancing, and then flowers falling from the heavens on our heads. It was a wonderful, beautiful experience. I told Lynn afterwards that I wanted to cry, and it had been years since I had wanted to cry doing something religious and spiritual. And if I may, there was just a moment when I said, how did I get here? How did I end up in Bombay with flowers falling on my head? I wanted to blame Maharaj, but I didn't think that was right. And then we traveled south for a week through Kerala. I learned it was God's own country. And while I was in God's own country, I said, how am I here? How did this happen? What decisions led me to this place? Because I felt like I had found a new family. Because family is so much bigger and more important than just who is my father and my mother and my brother and my sister. And here I was with a new family. And it was a series of decisions, and I love that Maharaj talked about decisions tonight. There were a series of decisions that had brought me to this place. In 1998, I was married to a lovely woman, and I had two children, and I had spent my entire life as a Mormon. Have any of you ever met a Mormon before? Well, now you've all met a Mormon, and he stands before you. And I had spent my life studying this religion, and I wanted to believe in this religion. And my wife wanted me to believe in this religion, and I wanted to believe in it for my children. But after studying and praying for years, I had concluded that I couldn't believe in this religion. I wanted to find something else. And I told my wife that, and she was very unhappy, and she left me. And she took my children and she moved to another state. And I was alone. And then came the first decision that brought me to Bombay. And it was when Lynn walked into my life. And she made a decision. I had left a message for her friend, not for her. And she picked up the phone and called me and said, I will come to your house tonight for a party to be with you. And she made that decision. And 1 week later, I still don't know why, she said, I love you, Devin. And I made a decision to spend the rest of my life with her. Unlike me, Lynn had traveled around the world. I had never traveled anywhere. So that was the first step in coming to Bombay, finding someone willing to go to Bombay with me. And in 1999, I had found Lynn. And the second decision came when I met none other than Gary. Gary's a trainer, and I called a gym and I said, I need a trainer. I was only worried about this body instead of my soul. Gary called back and said, in only the way Gary can say it, what do you want? Well, I'd like a trainer. And I went and I started to train with Gary. He got fired by Lynn once because he trained me so hard that I ended up in the hospital. And Lynn called him and said, thank you very much. I'll give you a check tomorrow, but you won't train my husband anymore. But 9 months later, I made a decision in my car, and I can still remember the place on Pacific Coast Highway where I made that decision to call Gary again and say, Gary, I think it's time for me to train with you. And we became close, close friends. And for years, he told me about Maharaj. And he told me about the miracle in the rice field in Nepal. And he would cry when he told me that story. I don't know if Gary remembers that, but he would cry. And it touched my heart deeply. Then there was another decision last July, because I had not met Maharaj yet. Lynn had. The year before, but we had been invited to come and meet Maharaj, and Lynn and I pulled up on a Friday night in front of the home where Maharaj was going to be, and it was late, and we'd been working hard, and I was tired, and I wanted to go home and see the kids and go to bed. I think Lynn did too, and I said to Lynn, maybe we shouldn't go in. There we sat on a dark street with no lights. And Maharaj was waiting inside, and we weren't going to go in. And we decided to go. And in we went. And it was one of the most beautiful evenings of our lives together, sharing that time with Maharaj. and he invited us here. And then there was only one more decision to make, and that was in November, in front of a computer, to push the buy button to purchase the tickets. And I sat with Lynn and said, do we really want to do this? I've only been to Mexico and Canada and Tokyo. Why am I going to Bombay? And she said, Gary's going to go. Let's do this. Let's go on the adventure of a lifetime. And all those decisions led me on the 28th of January to be standing in your temple with a new family with flowers falling on our heads. And as I thought more about it, I realized it wasn't just my decisions, though. It was the decisions of many other people. It was the decision of Gary to go to Nepal decades ago, and Maharaj to be there studying and have the miracle in the rice paddy. Without those decisions, I wouldn't be here with you. And I'm very grateful for that. We're staying with Nikunj Bihari, and I hope I say this right, and also with Radha Rani Priya. Did I do okay? Okay. And I told Radha Rani Priya last night that maybe this wasn't my new family. Maybe really this is my old family. That's how I've felt since I've been here. Thank you very, very much.
Shelley, would you like to speak something?
Hello. It'll be short, I promise. When I got here about a week ago, I'm going to be honest with you, I was never really a believer much in religion at all. And now, after a week, I can understand why it is so important in your lives. And I can say that I never was really a spiritually connected person. And now I feel somewhat connected. I never really felt before connected to God in any way, but now maybe just a little bit. And I came here with a little bit of love inside of me, and now it's almost pouring out of me. So I thank you all. Thank you very much. Thank you, Swami.
Thank you once again for having me here in Bombay. I've missed you so much that I came back. I'm like I'm the guest from hell. I never leave. I keep coming back. And it's just been great. Earlier this evening, my good friend Maharaj spoke about making every moment in your life count and doing the things necessary to serve God and elevate your level of consciousness. And as I was listening to him speak, I realized that I've never known anyone like him that truly lives every moment serving God and serving his community and his friends and his family and all of you. And I just am overwhelmed by gratitude for being a lifelong friend of such a wonderful, kind, loving, spiritually evolved person. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart and thank all of you for having me and for taking such good care of my best friend all these years. I'm so grateful. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I love all of you. Thank you for having me back. And I hope that I'll be able to come back and see you again. Hare Bol. My Aunt Shelley wants to express her love, but she's so bashful and overwhelmed, which I find hard to believe because back home she's never at a loss for words. Since she's come to Bombay, her basketball team is doing very well. They've won about 4 of the last 5 games, and she's thinking that it's because of all of you and because of the blessings of Swami that maybe the Lord is shining on a team that's been a perennial doormat. For years, they've been a terrible, terrible team. And suddenly, I read the paper the other day, and they're 12 games over 500 for the first time ever in the history of the basketball team. And she thinks it's because of you. So she's grateful, and she asked me to tell you how much she loves all of you, especially the lifelong relationship she's had with Maharaj. And so on behalf of one of the most beautiful women I have ever had the privilege of knowing, I love her more than life itself. She's my mother's sister, but she's another mother to me and a close friend. Thank you all for having her come to Bombay and all the wonderful things you've done for her. We, as a family, love all of you, and we want to thank you from the bottom of our heart. Thank you.
Sandy, would you like to speak something, please?
I was hoping you were going to forget that I was even sitting here, because it's difficult for me to speak without crying. You see, I'm like Alfred Ford. I was born in the right family and got the right brother. And I call my brother my passport, because through him, I have gone on many adventures. India is probably the grandest adventure that he has led me to, but he has led me to others. I won't go into the childhood stories because he'll hit me. But I can only tell you, he's been very special all of his life, and I'm very grateful for him and what he's done for me and for bringing me to such a wonderful place with people I cannot believe. You are just all so good. Also warm, and I've enjoyed every one of you. You are a blessing. Haribo.
Would anyone else like to speak? Lynn, would you like? Next year. It's on tape and videoed, your promise. I thank you very much.